support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Republican members of the New York State Legislature are calling for the repeal of the state's green light law. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley explains.
In 2019, New York implemented the green light law, which allows all residents, regardless of immigration status, to obtain a driver's license. It also placed restrictions on information law enforcement could obtain from the DMV. Republicans from counties bordering Canada were joined by county sheriffs in St. Lawrence County Tuesday to call for repeal of the green light law. Dan Steck, who represents the 45th District, says there is a crisis on New York's northern border.
So far this year, they've had 18,000 apprehensions in the Swanton sector, which runs from New Hampshire to Watertown. The next highest number is the sector out near Seattle, Washington, and that's just over 1,000 apprehensions. So 80-90% of the illegal crossings on our northern border are happening here. It's a growing problem, and it is very specific to New York State.
Steck explained that the state green light law prohibits local law enforcement from sharing any information about immigrants with other law enforcement partners. A bill has been proposed to exempt border counties from the law.
So now the people that are in the front line dealing with the illegal migrant crisis and watching the illegals wade through the muck and the woods and then down the streets and along farms and looking in windows and sleeping in outbuildings and barns and scaring kids on school buses, and this has all been in the paper. I'm not just whipping up scenarios here. This is all stuff that's well documented. They can communicate legally without fear of arrest. Can you imagine state government arresting, charging with a crime law enforcement officials? If I could put this in another way, this law is asinine.
Watertown Assemblyman Scott Gray, a Republican representing the 116th District, said it is fundamental for law enforcement agencies to share information.
It is unheard of that they can't share information, whether it's state police or whether it's local PD or whether it's the Sheriff's Department or our federal partners as well. So there's no question we need a course correction on this policy. The other important thing I think to look at, if we don't, as elected officials, take responsibility and put policy in place that allows these folks to do their job, we're going to end up with a vigilante situation.
Clinton County Sheriff David Favreau says the county's 28 miles of border have seen a significant uptick in illegal migration.
All we're asking for in law enforcement is a fair chance. Just an opportunity to use the tools and resources with other agencies so that we can partner to create a stronger bond to keep all of our communities the safest that we possibly can. I don't think that's a lot to ask for.
At the same time, New York border Republicans were calling for a repeal of the green light law, New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand introduced the Northern Border Security Enhancement and Review Act to update and strengthen northern border security.
This bipartisan bicameral legislation would require the Department of Homeland Security to analyze the current situation at the northern border and update its northern border strategy regularly. This proactive approach will provide us with the data and insights necessary to address the increasing apprehensions along the northern border and combat illegal drug and weapons trafficking. Until we update our northern border strategy, we will continue to be unprepared and unequipped to address this growing migrant crisis.
Gillibrand said she is not familiar with calls to repeal New York's green light law.
I think a law enforcement response is very helpful, and I do think coordination amongst federal and state law enforcement is always helpful. So I have to look at what they're suggesting, but we also do need to change the federal laws.
The proposed repeal legislation in New York applies only to border counties. Reached for comment, a spokesperson for Governor Hochul says she, quote, will review any legislation that passes both houses of the legislature, unquote. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
New York State's teachers are calling for a return to politics where democracy, compromise, and healthy debate are valued once again. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas has that story.
A Monday afternoon gathering of educators and elected officials at New York State United Teachers headquarters in Latham served to launch Common Ground Over Chaos, the union's statewide election campaign bus tour supporting its endorsed candidates. NYSUT President Melinda Person says the bus will make 40 stops in swing districts across the state.
As we stand here today, just weeks from Election Day, political conflict and the culture wars have been dominating our headlines, causing many Americans to feel resigned about our government. 42% of Americans say they are actively avoiding the news. Partisan conflict in Congress has become the norm, and polarization has made it increasingly difficult to solve problems. Republican and Democratic voters increasingly view one another not just as misguided, but increasingly as evil, using words like immoral and dishonest to describe each other.
Person says teachers instruct their students how to have healthy debates and how to disagree respectfully, and we should expect the same behavior from elected officials. Person says the candidates have signed the Common Ground Over Chaos pledge to work across the aisle, seek bipartisan solutions, and reject divisive politics. Democratic Assemblywoman Pat Fahey, running for the retiring Neil Breslin seat in the 46th District, says challenges have reached a critical level.
First with rollbacks on affirmative action, then with the horrors of October 7th and every day since then, and seeing what that has done on our campuses. And I've had countless conversations with both chancellors and countless university and college presidents about how do we encourage that civil discourse, that debate, that education, those history lessons, and yet still make sure all children feel safe, respected, and welcome. And we're still struggling with that. So I hope that you pushing in now, pushing into the classroom, and it working with children from pre-K right on through college, that we will remember that differences are okay. Let's respect, let's honor, and welcome and cherish those differences. But let's never forget our that we are united, and that there are so many shared goals and values that we need to get back to.
Fahey is facing Republican candidate Ted Danz. Republican state senator and former educator Jim Todisco of the 44th District says transparency, competency, and communication are the most important values elected officials should present to their constituents.
With them. They want you to answer questions when you're asked those questions, whether it's a debate, whether they call you on the phone, whether they come to your office and visit you, whether it's the media asking you questions. If you're going to interact, you're going to run, you're going to have to talk to them. And lastly, it's the hypocrisy question. Do you talk the talk and then walk the walk? And that is so important. And I believe if you're going to be a representative, you have to say what you mean and mean what you say.
Todisco has NYSUT's backing as he works to fend off a challenge from Democratic Saratoga Springs Finance Commissioner Manita Songvi. NYSUT says its Common Ground Over Chaos campaign will mobilize thousands of members across the state to make calls and knock on doors on behalf of endorsed candidates in vital swing districts. The bus tour runs through Election Day.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Sandra Ruffo, president of the New York State School Boards Association, to talk about the issue of school safety. You know, obviously we're concerned about student safety, we're concerned about school shootings, and this is one more financial burden put on the schools, right?
Well, it is, and we know safety is first. I mean, we can't teach students if they have compromised mental health, and we can't teach students that are not safe. And, you know, I recently looked at a statistic, and as of September 19th of last month, there have been at least 50 school shootings this year in the United States. That's a horrifying statistic. And, you know, there certainly is the issue, certainly for communities, as to our resource officers in the schools. For some, I know in my home district, the kids love the resource officers. And there's other schools that they feel that they're frightening to students. But they certainly have increased in numbers. They've doubled since 2019 from 200 to 400. So I think, at least from my perspective, having SROs within the schools are a good thing. I think there's a feeling of comfort when you walk in a school and perhaps they're there. But certainly it's a split opinion by individuals and parents.
How do you keep hope up? I mean, Sandy, you've been doing this for so long. And look at what's changed. Did you ever think way back when you first started a family and began working on these local boards, that you'd see a day when we were talking about police officers in schools and metal detectors?
No, but I think it's better we don't look too far ahead. I think we deal with the issues at hand as they come along. And, you know, we perhaps had issues back then. It's too far for me to remember that far ago. There were issues then. So it's just recognizing, and perhaps that's part of the disenchantment for some board members that maybe only last two terms, because they come in with lofty ideas and we're going to change this or we're going to change that. Number one, you have to realize that we only control a very tiny part of the budget, and that's one issue. And then I'm very hopeful. I'm hopeful for the future. You know, attending graduations and seeing these children and what they do, whether they go to college, where they're involved in a career, how could you not be hopeful? There are situations where students certainly are not in equitable situations as far as the education they receive. And I think that's part of what our State Education Department is trying to require with the regionalization studies that are coming, because, you know, you have some districts, and depending on the communities they're from, they're able to provide a number of, you know, AP courses. And as a result, you know, you see students that don't have the same opportunities. Very small districts that have 150 students or 200 students in the entire district. So in addition to, you know, their rural nature and the opportunities that they have, we want, through the regionalization, and I commend the State Education Department for proposing that we do this regionalization study so that we can find out where the educational disparities are, where the fiscal constraints are, and to be able to improve student opportunities and operational efficiencies. So it isn't consolidation. I think it's going to take an education process for people to understand we're not talking about consolidating schools. We're talking about sharing, pooling resources, you know, such as shared staff, maybe extracurricular programs and support services to provide all students with educational opportunities. And our BOCES, the 37 BOCES in New York State, will be convening discussions to develop regional plans to determine the strengths and weaknesses. It's an assessment questionnaire, which was developed by SED. And then every 10 years, there'll have to be a progress report that's done as well. So it's change. It's huge. Certainly, I think until people understand it, there will be a knee-jerk reaction about it. Like, you know, they're going to make our football team join with somebody else, or perhaps maybe take away something that we feel is very important to our district, and maybe we don't want to share. But I think the sharing will improve the equity in education for all children.
That's Sandra Ruffo, president of the New York State School Boards Association. We'll be right back. listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Women's Studio Workshop in Ulster County is celebrating its 50th anniversary with a traveling exhibition. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King with more.
Hi, are you Jesse?
Yes, I am. Hi.
I'm Natalie. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Since 1974, the art studio and publisher in Rosendale has been a space for women to create. Deputy Director Natalie Ranganeski says the workshop's four founders, artist Anne Kalmbach, Tatiana Kellner, Barbara Leoff-Burge, and Anita Wetzel, started it as a teaching collective for an art scene that didn't have many educational opportunities for women.
They found that they were being met with a lot of sexism, a lot of exclusion, and so they wanted to create a space where women's artwork would be elevated and permanently recorded in history.
Now the workshop boasts studios for printing, papermaking, ceramics, and more. Ranganeski says the workshop has served more than 5,000 artists and expanded its scope to include trans, non-binary, intersex, and gender-fluid artists as well. It has published more than 240 books over the years, some of which have found homes in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Tate Modern, and the Library of Congress. Its latest exhibition, called A Radical Alteration, showcases some of the organization's favorite titles. As Ranganeski points out, many of the books are works of art themselves, designed more for museums than for your home library. As we make our way through the gallery, she motions to a red film strip and cassette tape that, to me, looks like any other film strip and cassette tape, but it's actually made entirely out of paper. She says Carnegie Mellon professor Iman Ye went to painstaking lengths to recreate it.
She discovered this educational film strip in a closet, and she became totally fascinated by the idea that there was this fully defunct educational object teaching people about a medium, print, that many would argue is also becoming defunct. By recreating this object, she ensured that it was actually going to get recollected into all of these libraries and institutions, the kind that would have put this educational film strip into a closet.
Another book by Cherokee artist Rhiannon Skye Tafoya uses traditional basket weaving practices to form its pages. Ranganeski says Tafoya lived at the workshop as an artist in residence in 2019. The final product folds together to look like a basket and includes a collection of poems dedicated to Tafoya's grandmother.
One really exciting thing is that we were able to acquire a set of Cherokee syllabary letterpress so that Skye was actually able to do letterpress in her grandmother's spoken language, which was really beautiful.
So this will be the text block, and it's actually two books.
Oh, wow.
The workshop offers multiple residencies a year to artists of varying experience. One current resident is Ruth Carlin, a photographer and retired teacher from Chicago who is printing a new photo book she calls Carlin in Bed. The title is a tongue-in-cheek reference to the book artist Richard Minsky and his 1988 work Minsky in Bed. But while Minsky in Bed depicts intimate details of the artist's sexual conquests, Carlin in Bed is more literal. At 90 years old, Carlin has trouble getting around and spends a lot of time in bed with her legs elevated to address swelling.
It's boring. There's not a lot you can do with your legs up in the air. I mean, here I am with my iPhone, my legs up in the air, and I took a picture, and it seemed like a good idea, and, you know, I did several of them.
The result is an accordion-style book with several photos of Carlin's legs, sometimes at night, sometimes with a book in her lap, and always with a short caption handwritten by Carlin herself.
My constant companion is my iPad. I need a dog or a cat.
Carlin says her goal is not to poke fun at Minsky per se, but to provide a glimpse at what it's like to be a woman of a certain age, specifically 90. For the past week, she's been finalizing designs, printing out pages, and signing copies of her book, which the workshop will bind over the next few weeks. It's not a mass production. They're aiming for about 50 copies total. But Carlin says the whole experience has helped her feel seen, kind of like when she first bought her favorite red glasses.
When a woman is over 50 or 60, she becomes invisible. And I had gone from being harassed getting attention for my looks or being harassed for my look, and then becoming totally invisible for years. And in a way, it was a relief. I mean, there are limits to this nonsense. But then I bought these glasses, and I get stopped on the street. People stop me and say, "I love your glasses." And it's incredible. I mean, I'm no longer invisible, even though I'm a very old lady. And it's quite amazing to me.
Women's Studio Workshop will formally celebrate its 50th anniversary with a gala on November 16th. A radical alteration, Women's Studio Workshop as a sustainable model for art making is now on view at the studio through the end of the year. In 2025, it will make stops at the Minnesota Center for Book Arts and the National Museum of Women in the Arts in Washington, D.C. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Saratoga Springs welcomed farmers and their giant pumpkins from across the country for an annual competition and celebration last weekend. The Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella Levine was there and filed this report.
Pulpy Pumpkin Poundage was the name of the game Saturday.
353.
As hundreds gathered in downtown Saratoga Springs for the 9th annual Giant Pumpkin Fest. Andy Wolf is helping run the show with the New York State Giant Pumpkin Growers Association. He says if you can grow a garden, you can grow a giant pumpkin, but...
Oh, it can be exhausting for some people. Yeah, it's especially if you haven't, if you're not used to dealing with something like this, then... You know, you're talking, you know, a tractor, specialized equipment, and harnesses to actually pick them up and lift them out of there. I mean, onesie size back in the day, we would used to roll them up and get a tarp underneath of them and, you know, get the football team over and try to get them into the back of the truck without breaking them. But nowadays, we do a little bit easier with machines.
The pumpkins are lifted to the main stage's scale with a forklift and a special harness. Before weighing, they are checked for soft spots and cracks. Wolf says the best time to start growing a giant pumpkin is right now.
If you've got a piece of lawn that you don't like mowing, get out there and tear it up, bring in a truckload of manure, spread it out, and get it planted into a winter cover crop so you're preparing for next year to get that soil jacked up.
Wolf's pumpkin weighs in at 1,162 pounds, 14th place out of 24. That's about as much as one of the city's famed thoroughbred horses. Wayne Celo isn't expecting to win, but after 13 years of growing giant pumpkins, he's learned to just enjoy the day.
Within the first 30 days, you know whether you got a good one or not. They do most of their growing from 30 to 50 days. They'll put on 60, 70 pounds a day. So you actually can see them grow.
While rewarding, Celo says, the run-up to competitions like this can be challenging.
Mentally, physically, and whatever you want to put in there. It's tough. Everybody thinks these things are easy to grow. If you can get 1,000 pounds to the scale, you're doing something.
Pumpkins aren't the only thing on display. Christopher McDonald brought behemoth watermelons, tomatoes, and gourds.
And this is a giant string bean. I always say that I'm joking, but...
At 6'5", McDonald is standing in the shadow of a gourd that's at least 4 feet taller than himself.
Most people would know them as snake gourds. So when you grow it up a trellis, it'll grow straight. When you grow it on the ground, they curl into a ball. So you just grow it on a 12-foot-high, 14-foot-high trellis, and it hangs down.
For Andy DeSantis, oversized pumpkins are overrated. He brought a self-proclaimed smallest pumpkin, even though it's not an official category.
Guys, look at all the work they did on those 2,000 pound. This is 0.4 grams. 1,135 times lighter than a pound.
1,241 pounds. That is a big pumpkin.
Lois and Terry Nelson came from West Virginia to get their pumpkin weighed.
So we were scheduled to go to a competition in Elkin, North Carolina, which was about 7 hours from our home. And because of Hurricane Helene and everything, they got tons of water yesterday and they were flooded and under floodwaters. And so they canceled as we already had the fruit cut and were ready to walk out the door to drive. So when you have a fruit cut, you got to get it weighed. And we couldn't wait a week because if you wait a week, it loses weight.
It's their first time in Saratoga, but the giant pumpkin community's roots run deep.
Great bagels. Yeah, these people have been great, everybody.
Very, very nice. I say the pumpkin growers are happy people. And so we have a good time wherever we go, usually. And we knew a couple of the growers. Once we started traveling to New York, some of our other friends said, well, such and such is going to be there, such and such is going to be there. And so we knew them. So we know Andy Wolf. And so actually the pumpkin that we grew is from one of Andy's seeds.
Their pumpkin weighs 1,727 pounds, snagging third place. The weight to beat, 2,018 pounds by Jim Hazeltine. After the competition, the pumpkins are sold by the pound or turned into jack-o'-lanterns. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Shello Levine.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2440. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York state government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.